Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Marilyn Robinson, has said she has devoted her life to the study of America and Christianity. She is really smart. She has read so much. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. She's an essayist. And you're probably, many of you, familiar with this. We thought of her in having her on the show when we learned that President Obama had interviewed her. They had a conversation on September 14th while he was in Iowa. She's teaches at the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. And the president said, one of the things I don't get a chance to do as often as I'd like is just to have a conversation with somebody who I enjoy and I'm interested in. And so they had this wonderful conversation that was published in the New York Review of Books. A couple of years ago, President Obama met Marilyn when he gave her the National Humanities Medal and said to her, and I want to start the interview with this, because what a thing, a president to say to you as a writer, your writings have fundamentally changed me, President Obama said. I thank you. I think for the better, he said. Marilyn, I believe that. And so Marilyn is with us. She is the author of the Pulitzer Prize winning book, Gilead. She's author of Housekeeping, Home, and Lila, many nonfiction books as well. She has a wide-ranging, curious mind. Mother Country, Britain, The Welfare State, and Nuclear Pollution. She's written essays, articles, and reviews for Harper's, The Paris Review, and The New York Times Book Review. And her latest book is a book of essays, which is titled The Givenness of Things, Essays, Marilyn Robinson. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Marilyn. Thank you ever so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And you also, which I read, and I used to do this too, so we have this in common, and it made me want to make one of these again. You used to make a delicious lemon meringue pie.
It used to be the pride of my life.
Oh, me too. What happened to us?
I became aware of the calories in the pie, among other things.
Oh, I used to make it for my dad all the time. He loved it so much, and so it made him so happy. I just kept making lemon meringue pies, but I'll have to do that again. Well, I've been reading you all weekend, and the interview with the president was just so wonderful. But to have a president say to you, your writings have fundamentally changed me, is a pretty big thing when he's the president to say to you, Marilyn. What did he mean by that, and how did you take that in?
You know, at the time, I was so surprised by it that I you know, as they say, I doubted my senses. I thought he couldn't actually have said that. but it's been confirmed to me from many sources. Well, you know, I have enormous respect. Enormous respect for Barack Obama. I think perhaps more than I've ever felt for anyone that I've known.
Mm.
And he, you know, if I changed him for the better, that would be a real accomplishment, because I'm sure I started out from, you know, a very high level to begin with. I mean, he really is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very generous man. He does things that, I mean, in my experience, things that I certainly didn't expect, that being the first, and then this conversation in Iowa being another one. He's amazing. I mean, in the sense that he really does want to talk about things that interest him and so on. He's completely unpretentious, completely unself-protective in those kinds of situations. As you can imagine, saying I had improved him, I had made him better, not many people, no matter how deeply they felt that was true about themselves, would make that kind of acknowledgement, let alone the president of the United States.
Yeah. Absolutely. It was such a wonderful conversation. You just covered so many important issues. And from your vantage point, you must be one of the most widely read people I've ever talked to in my whole life. I mean, it's amazing, your body of knowledge. And he could keep up with that. He seemed to know a lot of what you already knew.
No question about it. He's a very brilliant man. He really is. I mean, I found that out the first time I had a chance to have some conversation with him. He has an extremely distinctive, brilliant mind.
Mm-hmm. When you say, Marilyn, that you have devoted your life to the study of America and Christianity, we'll get to Christianity in a moment. What do you mean, a study of America? What have you studied?
Well, you know, the literature, among other things. I mean, that my fondness is especially for the 19th century. But there, I mean, I think, for example, that Wallace Stevens, the 20th century poet, is one of the greatest poets that's ever written. And there's a whole huge body of extraordinarily interesting literature. And then the history interests me a great deal. I think that we have an odd... I mean, I think that most of our secondary sources historically are not terribly good. But I think I've tipped my hand. I think people know that I begin from critical assumptions. But, mm-hmm. You know, now, for example, this is just strange, you know, but I've gotten used to my eccentricities. But I found on the Internet a four-volume edition of the letters and speeches of Oliver Cromwell.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was only one copy of these, and you know, I got it. It was a steal. I think it was $650. And I have these things at home. I spend an hour every day reading about the English Revolution, which is an incredibly direct precursor of the American Revolution. And it's amazing how you know, I mean, that the people that were at the center of the English Revolution also before that time had begun to colonize Connecticut, for example, the same little group of people. And you know, you find out these things that are so amazing that nobody seems to be aware of, about the incredibly intense and elaborate relationship between the New England colonies and England, you know, in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like the Big Bang, you know. It's like, you know, you look at the thing and it's, you know, it's important for its implications. It's important for what blossomed out of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you don't have a good early account, then everything goes out of line. You don't understand what actually happened.
Right. And you and the president talked about that. I think the president was saying we have to know what happened during the Civil War. We have to know what happened during Reconstruction. We have to know about slavery. We have to know our history, or we can't really understand voting rights today, or taking away voting rights, or what's happening with Black Lives Matter, or what is present is so much. We have to know the past, don't we? And we don't. And you love teaching history. Are we learning it as we should? And if not, why not?
We aren't. I don't think there's any question that we aren't learning it well. We haven't written it well, for one thing. You know, one of the things that has been so striking to me, and I've talked about this before, is coming into the Middle West, into Iowa, and finding out that there's this enormously consequential history of this place. That nobody knows about. People here are not aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
It had everything to do with abolitionism and the Civil War, and before that, the creation of utopian communities that were integrated, and so on. Things that would be incredibly valuable for us to know in terms of what the character of, you know, the civilization in an earlier moment actually was. You know, people always talk about the movement into the West or the Middle West as if it were some land grab and there was nothing more to it than that. But in fact, it was, you know, in many, many cases, especially in the middle of the country, a very serious and important attempt to reimagine what civilization could be.
Hmm.
Very beautiful. And, you know, to lose that out of the narrative, it's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. I think that you were either talking to the president or you remind us of the fact that there were only two states that banned interracial marriage, and one was Iowa.
That did not ban interracial marriage.
Right, they did not ban it. I'm sorry.
Right, exactly. Yes, that's true. And, you know, I mean, those states, they were both strongly abolitionist, and produced all sorts of offspring that were utopian in their inclinations and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's no acknowledgement of the fact that there was a, you know, good, profound, idealistic thinking done, you know, in the 19th century that we could learn from, rather than simply dismissing it all or being interested only in the crudest things that happened during that time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about teaching for a moment. You are at the Writers' Room. I also went to the University of Iowa, so I imagine you in Iowa City. I loved Iowa City.
It's a great place.
Yeah, it is a great place. It is a great place. But you and the president talked about, and he mentioned the number of young people he knew who had gone into the teaching profession and just couldn't support their families. You also have a lot to say about this magnificent thing called teaching that we don't honor, that we don't defend, that is such an incredibly beautiful thing that democracy has given us.
Yes, it is so beautiful, and it is so much a living creation, you know, that if you set it back for a generation or half a generation, it's a very important loss to the whole culture.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that you hear more and more, frankly, in Europe as well as here, that there is something unnecessary and costly and extraneous, you know, about, you know, education in the arts and the humanities. There's terrible pressure on that. And this defines, I think, more than any other single thing, perhaps, the West, the culture of the West, you know. It was, you know, Europe and America both, before they had evolved to the sort of state of political liberalism that we see in them now, they already were doing magnificent things about what teaching and writing and all the rest that, you know, distinguished them in the whole world. We talk about defending our civilization. Only we are really attacking our civilization, and that's by undoing this sort of incredibly generous teaching that is really the hallmark of it.
Mm. I think at one point you received some kind of grant, didn't you? So you could just you could just work on writing for 5 years, and you couldn't stand it. You had to get back to the classroom.
I lasted for a year and a half, and then I resigned the grant. But, you know, I am retiring at the end of next semester.
You are?
Yes, I am.
Oh.
Because I've gotten myself committed to doing a lot of other things, other books and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And this semester, I have, you know, I have a wonderful substitute, Paul Harding, you know, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, I guess. So, you know, and that mitigates my guilt. Nevertheless, he's had to sort of fill in for me much more often than I consider to be appropriate.
Well, that's what happens when you have a conversation with a president that gets published, right? What did you expect?
I didn't expect anything.
And look what happened. We're going to welcome phone calls. Marilyn Robinson is our guest this hour. We thought about having her on the show when we read the conversation that she had in September with President Barack Obama. He wanted to speak to her. He said he didn't have a chance to have wide-ranging, deep conversations with people he really admired and respected. The main character in Gilead, the novel for which she won the Pulitzer Prize, is a character who President Obama said is one of his favorite in all of fiction, which is quite a thing to say. She won the Pulitzer for that. She's won all kinds of awards. Her latest book is a series of essays on the givenness of things, and we welcome phone calls for her. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email, talk@WPR.org. We're also on Facebook, where we love to read your comments, particularly if you've read her. You've really read her, so we'd like to hear what you have to say about Marilyn's work on her Facebook page, too, which is the Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marilyn Robinson is our guest this hour, and we have many phone calls coming in. Let's start with Carl in Madison. Hello, Carl.
Yes, hello, and what a gift to be able to give back just a little bit from housekeeping forward through Gilead, forward through your tremendous writing on the heart, the seed of our democracy. Marilynne Robinson's voice is, to me, sometimes at our worst times in our nation, like a message in a bottle of what is possible if we can just truly believe in what we're capable of. And so what an opportunity. I'm actually driving to an environmental meeting on which we're trying to stop a massive pipeline expansion to keep Wisconsin part of the climate solution. And here I find myself listening to this conversation, and I heard the word or the name Marilynne, and I knew that it would be one voice. And I don't know if it's hard for you to hear such wonderful things about yourself, but I have to say to the potential readers out there, in addition to all those who already know your work, when a person talks about the depth of Lincoln's ability to talk with honesty and clarity to a field of farmers without dumbing down his message because he himself had been a farmer and he assumed that they would gather the deeper meaning of his words, that is what America at its root is about. And your ability to distill that language and provide it like a gift to us is something that, if you haven't had the opportunity to read Ms. Robinson's work, boy, what a gift awaits you. Thank you for being who you are and for bringing your whole heart and your whole head to the work you do.
Oh, Carl, thank you for calling. Marilynne, what a call.
That was wonderful.
I'm very
moved.
And the president thinks the same and said that he hoped that people would go and read your books if they haven't read them before. One of the reasons that he did the conversation with you, he wants people to read you. And I'm wondering if that's happened in some way since your conversation.
the only evidence that I have is that my numbers have definitely gone up on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
My publisher doesn't tend to bother me with that kind of information, but I think without question,
yeah,
he has aroused interest.
Do you want to say I love Abraham Lincoln. I just love Abraham Lincoln. I thought Carl's comments about him were interesting. Would you like to talk a little bit about the goodness that exists in the American soul and how we've wandered so far from exhibiting that goodness in our national politics these days?
It's a very odd thing. Somehow or other, substantially, the politics has been taken over by a certain kind of conversation that most people don't want to engage in, frankly. People talk about money, and money's a problem. But I think it's the noise. It's the level of conversation where people insult each other and say things that are not true and, try to inflame fear in the public when fear is the last thing we need, and so on. But doing things that are very cheap rhetorically for very short-term gains of one sort or another in the polls, really. This is how would you enter, if you're a civilized person, how would you enter into a conversation like that? I think most people feel excluded from politics because they look at it and they think, these are not people I would choose to be associated with. It's very, and the thing about it is that it's called populist. But it was Abraham Lincoln that understood the people, It's people who talk respectfully and clearly and in good faith to the public who are the populist and not the ranters and screamers.
I love this response you gave to the president, and he asked you to amplify on it, so I want you to as well. This is an interesting comment. I think one of the things that is true, you said in conversation with him, is that many Americans on every side of every issue, they think that the worst thing they can say is the truest thing.
Yes, I think that's true. That's one of the criticisms that I have about the way American history is written. Because it's as if intellectual honesty requires people to edit out the fact that people did brilliant and courageous things for generous reasons, like the Yale Divinity students that came out into the Middle West when it was a complete wilderness, in order to establish an abolitionist culture here, you know?
Yes.
You find stories like that over and over again, people that did very good things that have had very, very long-standing benefit for the society. But what you have to do is talk about the sleaziest thing that happened, not simply to balance it, but as if that were the only history that mattered, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't, and, you know, you, it seems to me you see it in things like, you know, in contemporary culture, when someone tries to do something, you know, or say something, in the press it seems to be so consistently interpreted cynically,
mm-hmm.
as if it can only be understood as something that that person did calculating his or her own profit of some kind, you know, so that you can't even be given a minute to hear what might be the rational or wise implications of something that someone has said. It's just, it's as if cynicism were the only truth, and it becomes a principle of selection where it's all that you in fact hear.
It's fascinating. Kathy is next. Carl, thanks for your call. Kathy in Appleton. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I have a comment and a question. My comment is that there's a passage in Gilead where the father and son are examining a honeysuckle flower, and it is, I think, one of the most moving, touching passages in literature, and I just thank you for writing it.
Hmm.
And my question is, did you set out to write a trilogy, or did you just find after writing Gilead that there was more to the story?
The second is true. I would never have thought of a trilogy, you know, but I had characters still in my mind that were as strong in my imagination as the characters I'd actually written out at book length, you know. And I didn't see any reason not to give them their own lives, so that's what I've done.
Hey, let's hear just a little bit about, because I found when we were talking about teaching, I read that your brother, an extraordinary artist, visual artist, you said was one of your greatest teachers, which is such a nice thing to say about your brother. And here are the two of you growing up in Idaho, and he's this fabulous painter, and he realizes that you have a gift with words, and you're going to be the writer, and he's going to be the painter. And it's just an interesting growing up experience, isn't it? Because that shapes us. It shapes us, all of us, how we grew up.
No question. No question. I mean, when I try to trace back my life, which is a pretty, an unusual life, not one that I would have anticipated, but so many things, for example, wanting to read as widely as I can. And
have you ever? I can't believe how much you've read, Marilyn. It's unbelievable.
I owe it all to my big brother.
Aww.
He started me doing that sort of thing when I, it was all over my head. I was just imitating him.
And he went on to visual work, painting?
Mm-hmm. He paints. He's a recently retired professor of art history at the University of Virginia.
Ah.
So he's like me. He practiced his art, and he also taught in a university.
Hmm. And yet you say when you sat around the dining room table, you talked politics.
We did. I'm sure politics that would make my hair stand on end. But thank goodness it's all lost to memory. I don't know what it was actually.
Kathy, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Sarah in Lafarge, Wisconsin. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am just, for lack of a better term, I am a happy fangirl right now. there are many things that I could say to you, Ms. Robinson, but what I really, really wanted to point out is the significant contributions you've made, not only for our entire population, but specifically women, because your voice as a woman is so strong, and it's justified my existence as somebody who locks herself away to read books on hours on end, and I appreciate it very much, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Mm. Well, thank you. Yes, well, you know, I'm old enough to know that, when I was a girl, when I was in high school, there was never any suggestion that I, would teach in a university, for example. I'm old enough to know how recently there have been radical changes, And I think there's a way in which women are still living into the things that have become possible for them in the last generation or two. I think it will be fascinating, wonderful to see how this all plays out over another generation or two.
Mm-hmm. You're just full of so many, you read about your life and what you read, and you can go in so many directions, Marilyn. We need to talk about Christianity just a bit before we go, we go back to phone calls. But particularly John Calvin. I mean, who really has thought about John Calvin all that much lately? And here you are, and obviously he had a huge influence on you.
It's true. Well, the thing, he's had a huge influence on American civilization, especially the earlier literature that I love so much. Mm. And this is another thing that's been forgotten and dropped out of American history, or history altogether. During Shakespeare's lifetime, the writer most read in Britain was John Calvin.
Really?
But yeah, huh. I mean, he's very, very strongly associated with the great tradition of English language literature. Of course, he was, he came in by translation, but he had wonderful translators. But in any case, it's a hard thing to talk about Christianity because at this point, there's all this sectarianism that seems to me to be a huge departure from Christianity, although it calls itself by that name. And for me, it's a very engrossingly beautiful way to understand reality. And if it is, if it is culturally specific to a certain population, a huge one, by the way, to see the world in these terms, it is still it is so beautiful that it definitely partakes of truth. I say without prejudice to other things that might also, that can also partake of truth. But I think that we have done ourselves enormous harm by basically alienating the literature, the moral conceptions, the aesthetics of Christianity by either turning against it because it's considered some kind of bogus quasi-scientific explanatory system, or, all these narratives are made up about what it actually is, when if you look back a little way, if you read a little Christian theology, it's obviously about far other things,
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny thing because I'm so engrossed by it,
mm-hmm.
I know. That it's very difficult for me to sometimes, make the leap into the understanding of it that's pervaded in the culture. And I'm not talking about only the critiques that come from, the neo-atheists or anything. I'm also talking about the people that consider themselves to be its modern incarnation,
Mm.
It bothers me that it is no longer, in many instances, beautiful.
Oh, that's interesting. And where does it fit in an American society that embraces has as its creed to embrace all, to embrace Jews and to embrace Muslims and to embrace all other kinds of faith? Do you see those principles that guide you and that are so important to you as part of what America is, or is America more than that, all those other faiths as well, that somehow is incorporated into who we have become?
Well, in my view, Calvinism is enormously consistent with, with a multi-religious... What I'm saying, these things are hard to talk about, but the center of the Calvinist vision and ethic is that the human being is an image of God, and that this is true without any farther definition than simply the human being. Mm. So you have no grounds for treating any other human being with anything less than reverence. Mm. And, you know, I mean, it's not one of those step over a line and you become one of us kinds of religions. It's a whoever God presents to you is himself in his image, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the reasons that we were able to establish a universalistic culture is precisely because it grew out of that.
Oh, that's interesting. Very interesting. Isn't it something to be human? I mean, when you think about it, every day, this whole, here we are, taking in all these, every day, we're talking, and the fact that we can talk, and we're talking about all of these issues, and looking outside at the sky, and the honeysuckles, and wow, it's something, isn't it?
Who would ever have believed it? Who would have imagined such a thing? You know?
I don't know. Thank you, Sarah, very much for your call. Connie in Madison is next. Hi, Connie.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, and you?
Very lucky to be saying to Marilyn, you have companioned my humanity in so many ways with your novels first. You've companioned the nobility of the best of what universities have to offer us by championing a belief in our ancestors as just as smart as we are, and perhaps who had time for some greater wisdom than we seem to be taking time for right now. So thank you for championing the past's great minds and putting them up against, I would put them up against the best minds of our time. I'm tired of the mockery of the past as if it were benighted and had nothing to offer us. I want you to know that I think of the artfulness of your writing, the processional and almost, when I go into either Gilead or Home, I haven't read Lila yet, I feel like I'm entering a different gravitational space. There's a quiet that comes as you say what I think of as gigantically, permanently significant things, but you do this in a way that is so devoid of self-aggrandizement or gimmickry. You don't seem to be pulling on my sleeve in any direction. You just keep revealing these people and these observations that they have in a way that sticks with me so much. The final thing that, and you can pick anything that I've said to talk about, I don't also like the fact that disagreeing with someone now seems to make us enemies, so that ends conversations in a way that feels terribly wasteful to me. Finally, I want you to know that I just read Moby Dick for the first time with you in mind, because I know you've recently taught it, and I can't tell you how glad I am that I didn't read it earlier in my life. I'm in my 60s, and it is such a better book, such a more important book than I was even ready for. I read it because you said read it, but I was so deeply rewarded by that book. So thank you again for what you do to restore my soul.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
Look at how, boy, you have so significantly touched people. I feel like other than your books, of course, What do you think people should read? I mean, how do you know what direction? Because you've gone to Karl Marx, and then you read all the footnotes and the originals reading that for Karl Marx that he quoted. I mean, you do primary sources. You just it's really interesting. You should have a reading list for us, don't you think, Marilyn?
I think so, maybe so. I think people would be a little startled by some of the things on it. I mean, just because they are so obscure and so on. But
yes.
But, you know, really, honestly, I think people have to learn to respect their obsessions. I think that is the moral I can draw from my life. If something just sort of is on your mind, it seems like there's something more there than is on the surface, do it. That's how you learn who you are, in effect, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, I understand that fully. What a nice call from Connie. Thank you, Connie, so much. We go to Kate in Holman. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I just wanted to tell you that there is a very old woman activist. She calls herself the old woman activist in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Her name is June Chomey, and I read to her every 2 weeks because she has lost her sight, but not her thinking abilities. And your books are on our next choice to read.
Well, good.
I was wondering... Yeah, she's awesome. She would be part of Ladies in Black that would stand out in front of the post office opposing war and supporting Christianity. She's a very strong Christian, but also an activist. My favorite kind of person who lives her life based on her religion. But we're looking at, do we read Gilead first or The Giveness of Things?
Oh, well, it would depend on the lady herself, I think, which kind of what she's fonder of. I can't really tell you. I hope she would enjoy either one of them.
Maybe you could do one of the essays in Givenness, and then the next week you do a chapter in Gilead, right? You have to do
there
both.
Aren't any chapters.
You have to do both. Now, I have read that it's interesting that you've gone these directions, isn't it? Because you're such an exquisite novelist. But I think that I read somewhere that the book you wrote in 1989, Mother Country, Britain, the Welfare State, and Nuclear Pollution, I mean, who would have thought that you would be writing that and you'd be writing Gilead, too? But you are enormously proud of that book, are you not?
Well, you know, it was a hard book to write. I think it was probably as major a part of my education as anything I've ever done.
Oh.
It's it's about, you know, the British Nuclear Fuels, which is a government-owned nuclear system, which has poured a great deal of radioactive waste into the Irish Sea.
Oh.
But in any case, I simply couldn't imagine that, you know. I mean, this plant is very near Dove Cottage, you know, Wordsworth's little paradise. And I couldn't figure out how that could come about. And so I put it in the context of economics, which is incredibly important in British history. I started reading economic theory from the late 17th century and read right down through, which was a fantastic labor, although in all candor, they never change their minds about anything. So. And they haven't to this day. But in any case, I had to do a lot of social research and so on of a kind that into legal, you know, laws under Elizabeth and all these things.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a massive education for me. And frankly, it describes a terrible environmental problem that, so far as I can tell, has not been addressed in any meaningful way, which has been, it's been going on and expanding since 1957. So, anyway, if that were my life's work, I would be content with that as my life's work.
Oh, really?
Very painful thing to write.
Should I read it?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. No, thank you. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Marilyn Robinson is our guest this hour. She is Pulitzer Prize-winning author. Her latest book is The Givenness of Things, Essays by Marilyn Robinson, and they're on, just to mention a few, humanism, reformation, grace, givenness, awakening, fear, very important and highly mentioned essay on fear, theology, experience, son of Adam, son of man, realism, limitation, and we're delighted to have her with us. She teaches. She's retiring from teaching. She has other things to do. She's at the Writer's Workshop at the University of Iowa, where she has been, I think, about 25 years now, and she's the author of so many other highly acclaimed books. We're delighted to have her with us, and we just thought, you know, she did this interview, this conversation with President Obama, which is on our Facebook page. If you haven't seen it, it's really interesting. I would recommend that you read that. And we thought, well, why don't we have Marilyn on so we can have a conversation with her? And so she said, okay. So here we are. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Our Facebook page where you can read that interview and leave your comments is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Marilyn Robinson is our guest now. We have this email, Marilyn, from Jerry. Our daughter is the director of the Liberal Arts in Prison program at Grinnell College. She speaks with great admiration and gratitude for Marilyn's participation. Would she care to reflect on the state of incarceration in the country?
Well, you know, I haven't had enough experience to speak that generally. And I've seen, I mean, in Iowa, where I have visited prisons, it's very nice. I mean, it's nice that visits like that are encouraged. Classes are encouraged. The kids from Grinnell have done fantastic work, and the faculty too, bringing civilization, as it were. You know, I mean, the touch of the larger society, the good wishes of the larger society into this kind of environment. It's always impressive in every experience that I've had how deeply the inmates who want to be part of these programs read, how much, you know, real interest they take in what is given to them, how meaningful it is to them. I think that, there are statistics, of course, that demonstrate that education is the thing most likely to make sure that people who leave prison don't come back again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that what I have seen in Iowa is a pretty benign version of the prison system. I think there are many parts of the country where it really is a scandal and definitely, definitely needs to be looked at again. If we were the kind of 19th century reformers I'm talking about, we would be doing that now by whatever means, you know, were necessary.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, and I would love to hear you write an essay about what's going on in Paris for the next 2 weeks. It strikes me as this is such an important conference that's going on, and it's huge, isn't it? 200 countries, 150 world leaders, a moment in history where we simply have to do something about this issue, or who knows what the consequences will be. I wish you would write an essay about it. Did you think about, I know you follow what's going on in the world every day. What do you think about this conference?
I'd like to be there and form my impressions mm-hmm. of being there. You know, this recent business that of automobile emissions in Europe, you know, you wonder how much public relations is involved in, you know, how people present themselves in terms of what they're doing environmentally. And I don't know if there's anybody with a cold enough eye or a good enough lab or whatever to actually, to see what is actually happening. I mean, I read not so long ago that the Chinese had vastly understated their use of coal, because, mm-hmm. you know, that they understating it in what was presented as conformity with environmental reforms. And, you know, I think it's very hard. One of the things that is true of the whole global system is that people, you know, they try to profit by keeping costs down. And one of the ways to keep costs down is to be completely or largely indifferent to environmental consequences. You have this going on all over the world. And where money is involved in such a direct way as that, it's a very, very hard thing to police.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Let's go to Jim in Fontana for you next, Marilyn. Hi, Jim.
Yes. I was raised a very strict German Catholic, which is a very Catholic and German form of Christianity. But I'm a storyteller. I make my living telling stories and writing some. And dealing with the stories, everything, I tell everything from the Greek myths to, you know, Appalachian, Celtic-oriented folk tales. And I can't help but see all these connections between all these spiritual beliefs. And one thing that always stands out for me is paradox, the idea of paradox as being kind of a core of all spiritual traditions. You know, Christ was born in the manger, Christ is a Jew, for goodness sake. Yeah, on and on and on. So I'm just wondering if that idea, if you've wrestled with that idea of paradox. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jim.
I do think about paradox. I think that, it runs through, Shakespeare, all kinds of, a lot of the potency of his language comes from the fact that he makes paradox powerful in the things that people say. But I think that modern science, and by which I mean science after maybe 1750, saw paradox as a puzzle to be undone rather than articulating or giving a sense of the real dynamic complexity of reality, which the religious paradoxes and so on convey a very strong sense of. And I think that we would enrich our thinking quickly, promptly, deeply, if we learned again to respect paradox as being, descriptive of the fact that the world is not broken into clean categories or binary systems or something like that, there's a tension between things that would appear to be at odds, a tension that is like an attraction as much as anything else. But I haven't given a lot of thought, but I do think that that's one of the things that we have ceased to value appropriately.
We have time for probably one more phone call. Kevin in Baraboo. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having another author that I'll have to read now. I just finished Steve Inskeep's book, Jackson.
Oh, great.
My question basically is with regard to religion. And religion, it, to me, seems like it's kind of the problem in a lot of ways, because everybody thinks that their faith is the best, and if everybody would follow their faith, the world would be a much better place. But all of us are in so different of a place that we need to have more respect for another faith, because it's, totally different. We might not understand it, but there's good people with that too. And I'm also a retired artist that does some artwork, and I'm just interested in which book do you think I should read first?
Okay, we have about a minute left, Marilyn.
Well, I tried to make my books autonomous, so that they're not dependent on each other and you can read any one of them as a freestanding book. Most people, I think, start with Gilead, but that's just because it came first, but people it's kind of interesting. People that started with Lila, say, seem to have a different view of that world, which is, just interesting. I can't approximate any of these reactions simply because I wrote the books. I think that the quarrel that we have going on among religions now is not necessary and not even traditional for this country. I don't think the problem is with religion. I think it's with an impulse toward division that makes us antagonistic toward one another.
Thank you so much for the call. Marilyn Robinson, I'm so glad you said yes to doing the interview and for being with us. It was just a wonderful hour, and I appreciate your writing and your thoughts, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Marilyn Robinson, our guest, her latest book of essays is The Givenness of Things, and they're on all kinds of important topics. We also have on our Facebook page the conversation, the two-part conversation that was in the New York Review of Books. It's the audio of it, so you can hear Marilyn and President Obama talk about so many important things. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting hour, and to Scotty as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up. We'll be with you tomorrow.